Millions of people are living better. They are enjoying a healthier lifestyle, learning more about overcoming obstacles and keeping a positive outlook. Now you can be a member of the club. This is the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. Our guests share incredible stories and advice, bring new outlooks on wellness, and show you how to keep moving forward. Now, here is your host, Dr. Joe Casciani.
Thank you for joining us today. As you heard in the opening, you're listening to the Living to 100 Club radio show. I'm your host, Joe Casciani. We're very happy to have a returning guest to our show today, Dr. Michael Howard, to talk about better habits, better health. He was one of our early guests on this program, and we're delighted to have him back to share his in-depth knowledge about successful aging. Today, we'll hear more about the role that behaviors and habits play in bringing about and preventing chronic health conditions. As you know, this radio show is all about successful aging, and this means making the right decisions along the way. As we've said before, living to 100 is not a destination per se. It's about taking control and making more informed choices about our lifestyle, our eating, and our fitness habits, and our outlook. So before we begin, just let me give you a little background on our guest. Dr. Michael Howard is a clinical neuropsychologist, rehabilitation psychologist, and health psychologist. He's an internationally recognized researcher and speaker on aging and longevity, brain-behavior relationships, traumatic brain injury and concussion, dementia, stroke, addiction, and rehabilitation. During his 30-year career, Dr. Howard has had appointments to medical schools, head of neuropsychology and behavioral medicine departments, and directed programs for treating brain injury, dementia, addiction, psychiatric disorders, chronic pain, and other disabilities. Dr. Howard is the author of the book, Living to Be 100. Welcome back, Dr. Howard. Glad to have you with us today.
Hello? Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, great. Glad to have you with us today.
I guess I wasn't hooked in or something.
Okay. Well, we're connected now. So we're talking about behaviors and what behaviors contribute to chronic illness and also what behaviors can help us prevent them. So before we start, before we jump in to the meat of it, let me ask you about your background again, how you came to be so interested in healthy aging.
Well, you have to be honest about it, it's when I got old. I'm 75. By the time I turned 50, I got pretty fascinated by aging itself and the process and things like that behind it. And that largely led to the fact that I took a job just giving seminars to healthcare professionals and had all sorts of time freed up to do research and call and talk to researchers and all that sort of thing. And I got very fascinated by the people who had the longest, healthiest lives. And ended up finding about, I wrote the first edition of that Living to Be 100 about 6-7 years ago. I found about 24 studies around the world that looked at how people got to be 100 years old, especially the group that really fascinated me, which were the ones that lived to be 100 that could still live independently at 100 years old, which is 40 to 50% of them, nearly every study. Probably the most amazing people that walked this planet. And I started looking at the factors that predicted it. Most studies will tell us it's about 30% genetic, and it's about 70% the environment you're in and the lifestyle choices you make in that environment. Even though we're genetically a pretty homogeneous species, we haven't been around for a couple hundred thousand years, our genetic code probably is only about 1 to 2/10 of a percent different from every human on this planet. And yet, where you're born on this planet, where you live on this planet, the lifestyle choices you make in that environment begin to drastically impact life expectancy. You know, if you live in Monaco, your life expectancy is 88 to 89 years. You go to the south of sub-Saharan Africa, to Lesotho, and it's 44 years. And we're pretty much all the same critter. So the lifestyle choices you make in life, the decisions you make, begin to markedly affect how long that you'll live. And when I look at these 24 studies, and you know, the Dan Buettner, the guy that wrote the Blue Zones, and you know, the people that have looked at all this, one thing really stuck its head out as I looked at all these various centenarian studies, that the 70% of the variance had, you know, is determined by lifestyle, and that's how remarkably similar these 100-year-old people are. Wherever you find them in the world, the cultures can be very different. You know, Dan's four Blue Zones. You know, the first one in Sardinia, and then the Nicoyan Peninsula, Costa Rica, and, you know, the Seventh-day Adventists in Loma Linda, California, and the Okinawans, they have very different cultures, but very similar behavioral habits across the board. And I found about 16 of them that tended to predict pretty much that 70% of the variance. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to do it, because pretty much every study finds pretty much the same cluster of factors that tend to predict older age. But as I looked at this and began to look at mortality and things like that, something struck me, like lightning, I suppose. And I finally figured out the secret, the real secret, to having the longest, healthiest, happiest, because I interviewed 19 of these folks. I couldn't find a pessimist among them. Mm-hmm. The longest, healthiest, happiest life you can, I actually found the secret to it. And since we're on the show today, I'll tell you what that secret is.
Okay, we're eager to hear this.
Well, the secret to having the longest, healthiest, happiest life is you don't die. That's really what it's all about. you don't die.
Yeah.
So that brings up an interesting question. What's going to kill us? What's going to kill us? Because what I begin to realize as I looked at all this is the people that had these longest, healthiest lives got there because they either avoided, delayed, or survived the top 10 causes of death. Because 2.5 million Americans die every year. About nearly 2 million of them, nearly 80% of people are going to die of one of the top 10 causes of death. And those top 10 causes of death are largely brought about by our own behavior. They're not highly genetic disorders. They're brought about pretty much by our own behavior. I think the number one cause of death is heart disease. You know, heart disease is about 90% our own behavioral choices, probably 10% genetic, according to the Inner Heart study. And that's going to kill nearly one out of four people. Nearly one out of four people die of one of those cancers. And, you know, the Harvard School of Public Health looked at the top 10 lethal cancers and found that basically two-thirds of the risk to get those cancers are behavioral lifestyle choices, not your genetic code. And the third leading cause of death is COPD, you know, chronic lower respiratory diseases. I mean, what causes that? That's our own behavior. Smoking, secondhand smoke, air pollution we do to ourselves and things like that. Now, the fourth leading cause of death is interesting because it just jumped up from number five, where it's been for the last 30 years. And it's the CDC calls them accidental deaths. Well, accidental deaths are really three things. Three things are 95% of all the accidents that kill us. And that's, you know, auto accidents and falls. And the one that's made it jump up, of course, is what the CDC calls poisonings. And that basically are overdoses and drug interaction effects. And that's basically the effect of fentanyl. Fentanyl has hugely kicked up the opioid overdoses. It kills about twice as many as oxycodone and heroin now, either one of those. So it's now jumped up. Of course, these things are brought about by our own behavior. And the fifth leading cause of death is stroke. And if you put the two big C's together, cardiovascular disease, it's basically heart attacks and heart failures and stroke, and then you put cancer on there, your two big C's, 53% of Americans are going to die of one of the two big C's. And those are preventable, largely, conditions. Now, the sixth leading cause of death is Alzheimer's disease, at least according to the federal government. But, of course, nobody really dies of Alzheimer's disease. I've treated Alzheimer's patients on and off for 30, 35 years. You don't die of Alzheimer's. But Alzheimer's disease is the kind most people get, late-onset sporadic Alzheimer's. That's about 97% of cases. That's 50 to 60% genetic, but it's 40 to 50% lifestyle. And about half the lifestyle risk is cardiovascular. You get that. We can't prevent Alzheimer's because, you know, it's 50 to 60% genetic. But we can market lower the risk, we'll get it, because 40 to 50% is lifestyle. Then comes diabetes, and you know, way over 90% of those diagnoses are type 2, brought on by our own behaviors again, overeating and lack of exercise and obesity and things like that. Obesity is now considered to be 80% of diabetic diagnoses. Then comes kidney disease, and you might as well say cardiovascular disease, because almost 90% of kidney disease is cardiovascular. The ninth leading cause of death are the only two infections left on the top 10. Now, this is 100 years ago. Infections would have killed about half of us. Not today. Only about 2.2% die of either pneumonia or flu, and those have brought about a lot of our own behaviors, too, not getting our flu shots, not getting our two pneumonia shots, not covering mouths right, all that stuff. We pass these viruses along, a lot with our own behavior. And then finally, the number 10 cause of death is suicide. So the thing I found about these longest-lived people is they die of pretty much the same stuff we do. It's just most of them delay it hugely, way to the end of life, and have what we call a compression of morbidity and compression of disability. They don't tend to get the same things we get, but they tend to get them far, far later in life because they've had lifestyles that markedly delay the onset of these conditions, sometimes avoided them altogether. And here's the other thing that's part of our topic today. Many of them have these chronic illnesses, but they've managed them very well. There's 100-year-old people out there taking metformin, and they're taking antihypertensives and statin drugs and things like that, too. But medical science has helped us manage these conditions significantly. What it hasn't done is really made a huge effort to prevent these conditions, largely brought about by our own behavior. We teach docs in medical school to diagnose symptomatic disease, not to teach us not how to get these conditions. And unfortunately, most of these conditions are preventable, but we don't prevent them.
Sure. So that's pretty striking conclusions, where the top leading causes of death are largely attributable to behaviors, choices, poor choices.
That's what it gets down to. That's the large part of the variance.
COPD, accidental death, infections, suicide. Is this the 70% that's due to lifestyle? Then 30% is more genetic? Is this the statistic you're raising?
Genetic and changes in gene expression, the epigenetic changes in gene expression are about 30% of it. Aging itself, in most of the studies have been done, is about 25% genetic. So, you know, aging's built into our genetic code. We're born to die. It's because it's about species survival, not about our survival. So once we have perpetuated species, once we've got to about age 30 and we're through our kind of 16, 17 years of the time where we produce the best eggs and sperm, after that, our genetic code starts to pretty much just nail us after that. We start to pretty much go down. It takes a long time. But even identical twins age differently. There's really no such thing as normal aging. The Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging started in 1958. That was the first formal study of aging ever done. And by 1984, they'd figured out there's no such thing as normal aging. Even identical twins age differently. So our lifestyle choices begin to impact how our basic killer genes, how the genes that are trying to cause us to die, we begin to affect those things. And we can either attenuate those effects of those things, or we can basically just propel them and make it worse by our own behaviors.
Wow. Well, so we're going to talk more about the behaviors and behavior patterns and personality styles. This is very powerful information, Mike, because it shows how so much of our, you know, conditions are really attributable to behavior problems.
It really gets down to five things. I know this is going to sound terribly simplistic and redundant.
Let me break in before you jump into that. Okay. I want to just take a short break, if we could. It's time to take a little break. Please, those of our listeners, call in any questions you have. The call-in number is 866-472-5792, or you can send an email to info@living2100.club. This is Joe Casciani, and today's guest on our show is Dr. Michael Howard. You're listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club to experience the creative spirit, inspiration, and wellness information that you're looking for to maintain a healthy lifestyle, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find links to leading aging organizations and see our series of blogs. Get details about our weekly radio show and schedule of upcoming guests. Sign up to be a club member to receive newsletters and radio announcements and a copy of our member handbook, or opt for an annual premium membership with special access to our secure member forum and opportunities to ask the experts, plus transcripts of show recordings and other members-only offers. Visit the Living to 100 Club website for awareness, insights, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Are you living a healthy and fit lifestyle? It's not just related to your physical well-being. It also means a healthier mind, confidence, improved health, stamina, and fitness. Talking with Tremaine brings it all to you. Host Tremaine Ellis, along with her husband and co-host David Ellis, will offer support, advice, guidance, and motivation to keep you in your best shape, both physically and mentally. Talking with Tremaine can be heard live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and 3 Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Real Life Solutions, Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
All right, we're back. Thanks to everyone for staying with us. We're talking today with Dr. Michael Howard about healthy behaviors and, we'll say, not so healthy behaviors. Dr. Howard, we have a question that came in by email from Larry. Larry is asking, why do they often say a person died of Alzheimer's? What is it that usually causes their death? That's my understanding. Also, Alzheimer's is not usually the cause of death. So what is it
isn't, although it's a risk to get some of the thing. What happens usually in older, Alzheimer's is such a devastating condition. It so dominates when somebody has it, that when somebody dies, it's pretty easy to attribute it to. But the fact is, that's not going to go on anybody's death certificate if the doctor knows what he's talking about, because most Alzheimer's patients die because the immune system goes down horrifically at the time. They'll aspirate and things, lots of things start to happen, and oftentimes they'll die of pneumonias. Nosocomial pneumonias, you pick up in facilities because a lot of those critters go around, or microaspiration pneumonias from aspirating. But they'll die of heart attacks and strokes, malnutrition issues oftentimes because hunger, people won't nourish themselves well. Septic shock, they'll get infections and die of septic shock and things like that. So you sort of die with Alzheimer's disease. You don't really die of it most of the time, although it has made it more likely you'll get these conditions. It's usually another condition that ends up being the fatal condition.
Right. Good. That's a good answer. Thank you. Thank you, Larry, for sending in that question. So just before the break, we were talking about a lot of the evidence that shows how much our choices can contribute to the onset of these conditions. Yeah, during the break, I was asking about training in medical schools, and we know a lot of emphasis, obviously, is on treatment of these conditions, congestive heart failure, cancer, COPD, stroke, vascular disorders. So what's the story? Why don't we hear more about prevention? Why don't we hear more about educating the public about these are the things we need to do to avoid these chronic conditions?
Well, we have to teach, you know, going through medical school now is even more complex than it was 20 and 30 years ago. We have to teach these and teach medical students and residents so much about just diagnosing and treating symptomatic disease that prevention kind of gets lost. Prevention kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And what happens really is, you know, we can diagnose and treat disease at the latent stage. You know, we can say you're out shoveling stuff out of your yard and you start to get a little pressure in the chest or your left arm hurts, you're a little dizzy and short of breath or whatever. Then you sit down and everything's fine and you got angina and you can go in and find out your left anterior descending artery is 70% occluded when they do an angiogram on you. And we can go stent that in there and that's great. You can treat latent disease before it gets really bad. But most of the diagnoses we make of these top 10 cause of death anyway, oftentimes, are made once these things become really symptomatic, and they're chronic conditions. They're basically chronic conditions. It isn't easy to basically turn these things around once you get to that stage. It's very, very difficult to do. Look at the most common chronic illnesses. There's hypertension, happens over a lot of time, high cholesterol, arthritis, coronary heart disease, you get diabetes, chronic kidney disease, heart failure, you know, and of course COPD and Alzheimer's and all that, and the AMA calls obesity a disease now. These things all have developed over a long period of time, but we usually don't intervene to treat them until they get symptomatic, and at that point in time, it's often not possible to reverse a lot of these conditions then.
Okay, so just for our listeners, can you give us a quick differentiation between chronic and acute illness? It's pretty well understood, but just in your understanding, how would you differentiate the two?
Well, the research basically says and looks at is being kind of a three-month deal, first of all. Anything over 3 months, they start to call chronic, but that could go clear to a lifetime. And when you look at the acute stuff, usually that's a condition that can be either by itself or be treated and reverse itself, and you go back to baseline where you didn't have the condition within like 3 months or so. A chronic condition, you may be able to treat that down the line and bring it back to where it doesn't exist anymore, cure the disease, let's say, or cure the illness. But most of those chronic conditions go on for long periods of time, and many of them are not really curable. They're treatable, but they're not really curable. If you've got osteoarthritis, you're not going to cure that. You're pretty much going to have that forever. Now, you hope it doesn't get too bad, and you know you can. Most of us over 65 have it at some level or another, but it's not going to go away. You're going to have it for a long, long time. So the chronic conditions are really the ones that kill us now. You know, the first half of the 20th century, we really learned how to treat acute infections and all that sort of thing that killed us 100 years ago, and a lot of these things and the really quick things that killed us early in life. The last part of the 20th century, we've tried to figure out how to sort of treat these chronic illnesses and slow them down or delay them or avoid them, as we talked about, so they don't become the things, because they're the things that kill us now. We're not killed by these acute conditions mostly, although we still get infections. You still may die of an infection. But really, these conditions are brought on by chronic kinds of conditions over time, which is very different than what killed us 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, that's good. That's good. That's helpful. Thank you. So let's jump into personality types, and you talk about core beliefs and habits that people have that contribute to the progression of illness. Give us some broad breakdowns, if you could, about different personality styles and how they contribute to chronic illness.
Well, As most everybody probably listening knows, our behavior sort of falls into a pattern right around late teens or early adulthood. We call that pattern of behavior our personality. And it's basically characterized by a lot of beliefs that we form over time and based on really powerful memories that stay with us. And we develop patterns of behavior over time that sort of go along with these core beliefs because they stay with us sort of for long, long periods of time. And some of these personality styles can be they can be very unhealthy, and others can be healthy. Probably the first one most people have heard about is a so-called type A personality that came out of a couple of cardiologists, Ray Rosemond and Meyer Friedman, way back in the 50s and 60s, in which they thought really time-driven people had a lot of heart disease, that behavior pattern that they had based on their personality, which they call the type A personality, kind of led to higher levels of cardiovascular disease. Well, when a gal came in later and looked at that data, it turned out that A really stood for a subgroup of them that were angry people. They were irritable over a period of time. There were a lot of angry outbursts. And that personality style, we call type A personality, is heavily associated with the onset of cardiovascular disease and stroke and higher levels of Alzheimer's disease and things like that right now we know. So your personality patterns you form can end up being kind of an unhealthy one. There's a distressed kind of personality, people who don't manage stress very well. They have a lot of anxiety and depression and things like this, and a whole lot of these chronic illnesses tend to happen in those people at high levels. But on the other hand, let's look at the good side. I'm a positive side guy. I kind of look at the good side. There are some also very healthy personality types. There are very extroverted, self-healing types. There are type B, relaxed kind of personalities where people don't seem to get overwhelmed by stressors a great deal. There's a resilient personality type, a hardiness personality type that people manage their stressors really well. They bounce back after really bad things happen and cope with things, and they worry about things they can control rather than about things they cannot control. And these kind of personality styles are heavily correlated with either unhealthy or healthy behavioral habits. And those habits, because they're called habits, they go with our personalities a great deal. And it's one of the reasons why that these things are often difficult to, they're difficult to treat. They're difficult to cope with. When a personality tends to stay with us, it doesn't tend to markedly change a lot over time. And so when these personality styles get like this, they're very difficult oftentimes to change our bad health habits. I think the one question I get more than anything else when I do these seminars and do lectures in med schools or whatever on healthy habits is, how do you get people to change their bad health habits? And the answer is with a great deal of difficulty because mm-hmm. they're habits.
You bet.
Because they're habits.
Yeah, changing behavior. Let me back up just a minute if we could. As we talked about type A personality and stress-driven, what about conditions like obesity? What kind of personality, style, beliefs contribute to that obesity, overeating lifestyle?
Well, the answer is there is none.
There is none.
And that's one of the interesting things about this. I'm a believer in what we call the biopsychosocial model of most kinds of chronic illnesses, which means our biology is affected by our behavioral choices, which are in fact impacted by our social and physical environment around us. Since 1980, the obesity rates in this country have skyrocketed. 71%+ of us now are either overweight or obese in this country. That's a dramatic increase in the last 40 years. And one of the main reasons is the food industry began to change the way that they both processed and marketed food. They have many more foods that were processed foods that were laden with high calorie, sweet, salt, and fatty tastes in there that our brains find very pleasurable that never existed on this planet before. You can't find a natural food that has sweet, salt, and fat in the same food. But you can find it down at the supermarket. It's full of them. And they markedly changed that. Well, our behavior, and then they changed the way supermarkets were constructed. It's complex what they did. But they made it an absolute goal of theirs to get us to eat more food, because they make more money and they make more profit margins on these processed foods that have all the sweet, salt, and fat in them that our brains find so hard to resist. But nonetheless, we must choose those foods, take them home, eat them, cook them, do whatever we do, and that's our own behavior. The food's there. We have to choose it and pick it, and our behavior begin to change, not with one personality style or another. Many personality styles involved in this. We're simply craving these sweet, salt, and fatty foods, and they're out there, and we develop the habits of eating them, so we continue to do it. Compared to 1980, the average woman consumes about 270 more calories per day, and the average man about 218 or 20. The reason we got the obesity epidemic is we simply consume more food. Exercise less a little bit too, but it's mostly just taking in more calories. And that begins to affect our biology. And our adipocytes get bigger. All the things that change in our body and obesity get bigger. It becomes a risk factor of so many other conditions. But the thing to realize is the environment played a role, our behavior played a role, and our biology got affected by that. And our genetic code is sort of built in to make us want to eat a lot of food too. It's left over from the Stone Age. You know, we found food we wanted to eat as much as we could back then. We're attracted to sweet, salt, and fatty foods because that's what made us. So our genetic code works against us. And then once we gain weight, our bodies seem to change our set point, if you want to call it, up to that overweight level, because the body seems to think there's a big famine coming or something. You don't want to lose weight. So when you start to lose weight off of that overweight condition, many things kick in. Your cravings kick in. Your hunger kicks in to bring you back up to that overweight level again. So you got biology, our behavior, and the environment all working together to create this condition of obesity. It isn't just one of them. It's an interaction of all of these things working together. And there's not one really personality style that really evolves into obesity. It's many different personality styles are involved in that behavior pattern.
Yeah, so the food tastes good. I mean, there's a lot of forces working against us. I mean, we always talk about the learned helplessness model and depression and how that contributes to overeating and the fact that I have no control over my world, over my environment. So, but you're saying it's more than that. There's much more than that.
Well, it is. It's more than that, but that's still an important thing. The thing about our core beliefs we form over life, we tend to think about things in patterns and form these memories, and we form our beliefs about things. The Greeks call them ideas. We form our beliefs about things, the world around us, and those become hugely powerful, and we don't want to give them up. We don't want to give them up, even if they're horrible. We don't want to give them up. Think of a depressed person and what a typical cluster of core beliefs that person has. Life is awful. Everything I'm going to do, I'm going to fail. That's their belief. I'm helpless to do anything about it. It's a hopeless situation. And I think the one that's most dangerous, probably the one most correlated with suicide, the core belief that nothing in life gives me any pleasure. Now, those are terrible core beliefs that cause people to feel awful, but depression's hard to treat for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons is it's really difficult for people to give up their core beliefs, even if they're bad core beliefs. It's hard for them to give them up. And they'll fall back into those patterns again because they're so habitual over and over again. So turning around those self-destructive core beliefs is one big aspect of treating depression. It's not the only way we treat depression, but it's certainly a tremendous aspect of it. And one of the reasons why people, you know, relapse and come back into depressions again and again and again. They fall right back into those habitual core beliefs that are part of their personality. And it's tough to turn those core beliefs around.
Sure. And that's the benefit of cognitive behavior therapy, of course, because we're able to address a lot of those illogical core beliefs that have contributed to such destructive behaviors. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The other point I wanted to make, we had a guest on a few months ago, Nick Buettner, who's the brother of Dan Buettner of the Blue Zones. And Nick was talking about, yeah, lifestyle can be improved by choices that we make, but it's also necessary to change the environment. So in his perspective, the more we can create competing restaurants or competing aisles in the grocery stores that offer healthier foods to allow us to make healthier choices, it's hard to do away with what's already out there. It's hard to do away with all these fast food places. But if we can introduce some other entities, organizations, food products, stores where we can have access to healthier foods, that's going to change. I mean, that's going to be in our favor anyway, which makes sense.
The problem, of course, is our biology and our genetic code. Our genetic code and our biology left over from the Stone Age when food was scarce, and we basically had to stuff ourselves when we got it. When we were attracted and we feel pleasure with sweet and fatty foods that are high in calories, and if you throw salt in there, the food industry calls the combination of those three tastes, which are called hyper-palatable foods. Those are foods that are not just desired, which are palatable foods. They're hugely desired because they've got all three of those tastes to give the brain pleasure combined together in what the food industry calls the bliss point. They reach a point when it goes in your mouth, it's just unbelievable pleasure when it goes in there. And we've formed those habits really, really significantly. And I like the fact there's more healthy choices out there in restaurants now that you're seeing them. But trust me on this, and I've seen the data, McDonald's doesn't make their money off their salads.
No.
No, okay. That's just there for lip service only. They're making their money off sweet, salt, and fatty foods that are hugely high in calories that we love to eat. And if a food's hyper-palatable with sweet, salt, and fat in it, we'll consume that food beyond where we're satiated by hunger because we're eating for pleasure. We're not eating to satisfy our hunger now. Yeah. And you'll eat even beyond that. So we just consume more and more calories.
Okay. Hold that thought, Mike. It's time to take a short break. For our listeners, please call in any questions you have. The call-in number is 866-472-5792. Or send an email to info@living2100.club. This is Joe Casciani, and today's guest is Dr. Michael Howard. You're listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club to experience the creative spirit, inspiration, and wellness information that you're looking for to maintain a healthy lifestyle, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find links to leading aging organizations and see our series of blogs. Get details about our weekly radio show and schedule of upcoming guests. Sign up to be a club member to receive newsletters and radio announcements and a copy of our member handbook, or opt for an annual premium membership with special access to our secure member forum and opportunities to ask the experts, plus transcripts of show recordings and other members-only offers. Visit the Living to 100 Club website for awareness, insights, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Sometimes it just seems that nobody understands. There's one individual who can help. If you're living with somebody who faces challenges such as autism, Asperger's, or other exceptional needs, you'll want to tune into Solutions and Strategies with Dr. Sean. Living the Challenge. Together, we'll uncover a variety of solutions to the challenges faced by individuals, their families, and teachers. Listen live every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective, plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite hosts. It's just a click away at blog.voiceamerica.com. That's blog.voiceamerica.com. The Voice America Press Blog. All access, all the time.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@living2100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
Okay, we're back. Thanks to everyone for staying with us. We're talking today with Dr. Michael Howard about healthy behaviors. Mike, let me ask you from a different perspective. We talked about a lot of the behaviors that contribute to chronic illness. Let's look at the behaviors that help us avoid illness, as you talk about avoid, delay, or overcome. Those are the three ways to manage. What are some of the behavior changes? What should we adopt to stay healthy longer?
Well, three huge studies all came almost the exact same conclusion. If you want to add anywhere from 15 to 18 healthy years to your life, there's five simple things in life that largely predict that. And I call them the five fickle fingers of fate, but I mean, it's five things basically that make the biggest difference in avoiding, delaying, or surviving those top 10 causes of death and having the longest, healthiest life you can. And the first is to try to keep your weight in the normal range. Well, 71%+ of us now are overweight or obese. So we're talking only 29% of our population, basically, has a weight now in the normal range. And some of those are underweight, and that's not good either. There's a Goldilocks thing involved here. You want to kind of stay in the average range, and generally that's called a body mass index of 18.5 to 25, but and then have a pretty good waist. So don't get over, keep a normal weight. Number two, eat a healthy, mostly plant-based diet. We're really herbivores, designed to be herbivores. All higher primates pretty much are plant eaters. We should be getting most of our calories from plants, and most of the longest-lived, healthiest people do. Doesn't mean you can't eat red meat or you can't eat the other kind of stuff, but look at the Mediterranean diet. Look at the DASH diet, the dietary approach to stop hypertension. Look at the MIND diet, which has been shown to lower Alzheimer's risk, which is a kind of a combination of the DASH and Mediterranean diet, or the Harvard Healthy Eating Plate or the USDA My Plate. They're all pretty much the same thing. They're all trying to get you to eat more fruits and veggies, less saturated, less butter, and less red meats and processed meats and sweets and stuff like that. They're all pretty much the same thing. And lower the amount of calories we're eating in. And then the next thing, of course, is regular at moderate exercise. Not too much, Goldilocks again, not too little, but probably 30 to 40 minutes, 5-6 days a week, walking 100 steps a minute or so, moderate level of exercise, getting your heart rate up, maybe 60-70% of your max rate. That's 220 minus your age, right in that level like that. And not doing too much, because too much can be an issue there, too. So normal body weight, you know, good, healthy, plant-based diet, exercise. And the last two are pretty simple. Don't smoke and don't drink alcohol to excess. But here's a scary thing. Only 1% to 3% of the population in the United States do those five things regularly in their lifestyle. Have a normal weight, pretty healthy plant-based diet, 5-6 servings of fruits and veggies a day, exercise at that level on a fairly regular basis, don't smoke, and don't a man don't have over 2 drinks a day and a woman over 1 drink a day, that's 1% to 3% of the population. The reason we're number 42 in the world in life expectancy, 41 countries outlive us, 193 sovereign countries are in the UN, 41 of them outlive us, largely because we don't do those five things. Now, it's not that healthcare is not important, health insurance isn't important, but the research tells us that's about 15 to 20% of how long you're going to live. Most of them are going to give you lifestyle choices. And what are those lifestyle, what are those five things? I'll tell you another fascinating thing is there's a guy named Gudars Dane. He's at the Harvard School of Public Health. They did a study looking at the top 12 things that kill us. Now, not the top 10 causes of death, but the things that contribute to the things that kill us. And real quick, I'll tell you, smoking, high blood pressure, excess weight, physical inactivity, high blood sugar, high LDL cholesterol, high salt intake, low omega-3 omega-3 fatty acids, that's what you're getting from fish. Your high trans fats, alcohol overuse, low fruits and veggies, and low plant polyunsaturated fatty acids. Well, if you look at those, that's the five fickle fingers of fate. Every one of those things is either body weight, alcohol intake, smoking, diet, or exercise. It all boils down to those five things. And if you do those five things, you begin to lower the risk. If you do those five things, you begin to lower the risk that you will get those top 10 causes of death, because that's really what's going to kill us. Heart disease, you know, you keep your weight, you exercise regularly, don't smoke, manage your stress, you know, get your flu shots, you know, anything that don't get depression and stuff like that. Look at your dental care, all that kind of stuff, and keep your cholesterol where it is. Very same things we've talked about.
Sure.
Look at the cancers. The most lethal cancers for women are lung, breast, colorectal, and pancreatic. For men, lung, prostate, colorectal, and pancreatic cancers. Well, those things are a lot due to not only our own behaviors, but getting our screening tests for those things. Cancers have gone down as a cause of death because of the screening test for some of the lethal cancers, whether it's breast cancer, getting your colorectal stuff done, a prostate cancer screening, using stuff to protect your skin, sunscreens and all that. COPD, third leading cause of death, that's simply smoking, secondhand smoke, and air pollution largely is causing that. And stroke, well, that's a number five now, but stroke pretty much, if you look at your carotid arteries and atrial fibrillation of the heart, where the upper atria kind of flutter a little, the rest of them are all pretty much the same risk factors to get heart disease. It's the same kind of things. You're going to lower the risk to get that. Accidents, don't be distracted when you're driving. You know, don't drink under the influence. The drugs, the overdose thing, be careful with drugs like that, and make your home fall safe. That's behaviors as well. There as well to do that. It's the very same behaviors we're talking about across the board. Alzheimer's disease, lowering the risk for that, those top five things I just told you about, can markedly reduce the risk. You can't prevent it, but we reduce the risk you get Alzheimer's disease. Keeping your brain busy, staying socially engaged, all that sort of stuff. Diabetes, right from the American Diabetes Association, the top five things to prevent diabetes are the five fickle fingers of fate.
Sure.
Exactly right there. That's how you don't get diabetes. And then kidney disease is basically lowering your heart disease risk. Pneumonia and flu, get your shots. You know, cover your mouth really well, cough in your elbows. Once you start getting symptoms, get the best treatment you can get as fast as you can. And then suicide, you know, depression or suicide hotlines and things we can do to lower the risk, we get that too. That getting those top, those things up there, the things that really will kill us, those things up there are largely preventable conditions, and we can lower the risk we'll get them just by some very simple, logical behaviors that are pretty much under our control.
Sure. Right. Well, good. I mean, those are the essentials. I agree. But what would you say to any of our listeners and listeners thinking, gee, I've heard all this before. I've gotten this information. I understand about plant-based diet and weight and smoking. What's the one thing this person should do, Dr. Howard? What one thing do you recommend that they start with?
Well, when I work with people, I believe if you really want to do something and there's motivation to do it, you make a plan. And that plan, to me, always, I'm just a farm boy from Kansas. I'm about as simple-minded as you can get. You try to work on maybe one, two, or three things that you want to change in your life. Make the goals you want to do so you can get to them short-term, and then to shooting for kind of a long-term goal. Get your motivation to do it, why you want to do it, because everybody's going to be different. Everybody's going to have different things that's more important to them to change than something else, and sometimes your doctor that can help you with that. But get a plan to do it and how you want to do it. And the people I worked with, we always made a written plan and stuck it up on the refrigerator so you saw it every single day, what it is we're trying to do, because changing habits is difficult. It's very difficult. Just think about people that want to lose weight. and how over 90% of people basically go on some weight plan, and 6 months to a year later, they're right back at the weight they were above, because these plans have to be reachable, and you have to be able to do them well enough. You can't make plans beyond your capacity to do them, and realize that these changes largely are about the long term, they're not about the short term. They're about slowly modifying our habits so we can change our behavior over long periods of time to reach the goals that we want to get to. This isn't something that just one diet change or one major life, one thing is going to change. It's about really changing a lifestyle, and, you know, our lifestyles are habits, and they're difficult to change. So I think you never try to work on over two or three things at once, and you make those things achievable in the short term and the long term. You get reward yourself for doing it, because that'll be built into it. You're doing it for a reason, to take care of yourself, and give yourself short-term rewards for doing it as well. That's the plans that I worked with, the people where it's weight loss or getting your blood pressure down or whatever else, that tended to work for people.
All right, that's some good advice. Set some objectives, create a goal, one or two goals, short term, 6 months. That's some good advice. Looks like we're out of time for today, I'm sorry to say. Thanks for being on our show today. How can people contact you if they want to get in touch with you, Michael?
Oh, if you want to, I'm at mehowardphd@yahoo.com. mehowardphd@yahoo.com.
Great.
I don't know if I'll have any kind of advice for anybody that makes any sense, but you're welcome to give me a shot.
Okay. Thanks again for being on our show today. And to our listeners, you're real welcome. Just a reminder about visiting our website. Subscribe to our announcements and weekly blogs, and sign up for a premium membership to get a complimentary copy of the book about the Blue Zones by Dan Buettner, and a copy of the movie Lives Well Lived by Skye Bergman. Thanks to all of you for being a listener and for your support on our radio show. Hope to see you next time.
Thank you for being part of the Living to 100 Club. We hope you'll join Dr. Joe Casciani again next Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until next week, stay on the right track to mental and physical fitness.